Now, if I had as much money as Rhodes, I'd have no ex-associates bad-mouthing me. They would be preaching the gospel of how God's will was fulfilled as they banked the money. But now they have to find a way to say that their sin that caused them to leave was really not sin. I'm the sinner. These men formed their intellectual growth. I'm leaving Quigley for a minute. I'll go back to him. These men had formed their intellectual growth at Oxford on the New Testament's Sermon on the Mount. The last was especially influential on Lionel Curtis. He had a fanatical conviction. Listen close. And country hop with Kissinger. He had a fanatical conviction. Listen close and talk across the table all day to Korean representatives, North and South. He had a fanatical conviction. Listen close and watch him run around the Middle East to talk. He had a fanatical conviction that the proper spirit, that with the proper spirit, listen close, and hear all of the brainwashed people that say, why doesn't Scott compromise and talk? How come he throws the gauntlet down and says, get off my pee-pee? Priority position rights in the Constitution. Listen close. Lionel Curtis, influenced by the Sermon on the Mount, the ethical approach to Christianity. He had a fanatical conviction that with the proper spirit... Isn't it too bad Scott doesn't have a proper spirit? He had a fanatical... Shall I finish this sentence? He had a fanatical conviction that with the proper spirit and the proper organization, he's just a one-man show. If he had organized. I'm going to finish it this time. He had a fanatical conviction that with the proper spirit and the proper organization, that is, local self-government and federalism, the kingdom of God could be established on earth. It's liberalism that has man bring in the millennium by his own efforts. It's liberalism that says sin is ignorance and salvation is education because those who are saying it have it. It is liberalism that believes man will bring the kingdom of heaven onto this earth. It's evangelical, biblical Christianity that says the answer must come from outside history by the second coming. The problem with the Christian church today, it is an overpopulated Galatian church that so quickly, having begun right, because the basic formula of salvation that starts Christians on the path in just about every evangelical denomination is right. Their starter is right. But inevitably they slip into a grafting on of the old. Too many of them are unphilosophically trained, and the implications of their quickly wrought out sermons grabbed off of a textbook from an Anglican pulpit. And like the Galatians, they get bewitched into the do-goodism, sweet-talkism, bow-down-to-governmentism of liberal Christianity, which makes them go along, sweeping up behind the forerunner of the white horse of Antichrist with his bow and no arrow. Giving away fossilized rocks for a $100 donation that they swear might have been dropped by the jackass Jesus rode on into Jerusalem. I had some of you going with me and I just lost you. I don't want you to get the idea that I'm one of them. Don't shut up laughing, Keith. You're going to get me tickled. He had a fanatical conviction that with the proper spirit and the proper organization, the kingdom of God could be established on earth. I may stay here till midnight. What do you want to go anywhere for? He was sure that if people... Just think of the people that just tuned in. He was sure that if people were trusted... Listen close. He was sure that if people were trusted just a bit beyond... He should have had to get workers that he couldn't pay any more than I paid. Then he'd learn about trust. He was sure... I'm going to finish this sentence too. He was sure that if people were trusted just a bit beyond what they deserve, they would respond by proving worthy of such trust. Anybody want to hear it for salt treaties? As he wrote in The Problem of a Commonwealth in 1916, quote, if political power is granted to groups before they are fit, they will tend to rise to the need. You know what that flows from? The liberal doctrine that man is basically good. You know what Paul says? Man's corrupt according to deceiving lusts. That's the difference. If political power is granted to groups before they are fit, they will tend to rise to the need. He was mostly influenced by the Sermon on the Mount. Too bad he didn't read Paul. This was the spirit which Milner's group tried to use toward the Boers in 1902 to 1910. You want to know a little bit about the Boer War? There's a movie out by some Australians that you ought to see. Can't think of the name of it right now. I'll think of it. Somebody will help me probably. This was the group used toward India in 1910 to 1947. This was the technique used, unfortunately, toward Hitler in 1933 to 1939. Any of you remember that in your history? This is the technique my evangelical brethren would use toward government today. You see the analogy? Win them with goodness. Why can't Scott be a little more loving? Because, friend, I've been in the jungles and run into snakes. Have you? This point of view was reflected in Curtis' 3 volumes on world history, published as The City of God in 1938. In the case of Hitler, at least, Quigley's having a hard time with this section. In the case of Hitler, at least, these high ideals led to disaster. This seems also to be the case in South Africa. Well, now I'm going to skip 900 pages. Give you the meat of it. You say, where were you going? Here. The roundtable groups have already been mentioned in this book. Yeah, I'm at 950 pages in. You say, what do you do in your spare time? Throw darts at monkeys. The roundtable groups have already been mentioned in this book several times, notably in connection with the formation of the British Commonwealth in Chapter 4. And in the discussion of appeasement in Chapter 12, I'd like to mail that out to my evangelical brethren who want to make peace in the NRB with the FCC. If you treat them good, they'll be good to you. At the risk of some repetition, the story will be summarized here. Because the American, now we're in American history, the American branch of this organization, sometimes called the Eastern Establishment, has played a very significant role in the history of the United States in the last generation. Boy, I'll say they have. The roundtable groups were semi-secret discussion and lobbying groups organized by Lionel Curtis, he's the Sermon on the Mount man, Philip Kerr, Lord Lothian, and Sir William Morris in 1908 and 1911. This was done on behalf of Lord Milner, the dominant trustee of the Rhodes Trust in the 2 decades, 1905 to 25. The original purpose of these groups was to seek to federate the English-speaking world along lines laid down by Cecil Rhodes. Are you catching a picture that what this group is out to do is to do that which is for the good, the common good of all. Can you see the seeds of the common good of the people of California that the state and the elite could manage? I mean, here's some money that these groups don't control. God's money. So we've got to make sure it's also managed for the common good under old common law theory. And I got churchmen out there that think I didn't know what was going on. And that I was fighting for myself. Most of the preachers who criticized me couldn't make as much money in a lifetime as I could make in a year if I quit preaching. The round table groups were semi-secret. The original purpose of these groups was to seek to federate the English-speaking world along lines laid down by Rhodes and Stead. And the money for the organizational work came originally from the Rhodes Trust. By 1915, round table groups existed in seven countries. This is long after the Declaration of Independence, but it's still being dominated. By 1915, in seven countries, including England, South Africa, Canada, Australia. You know, I was invited in university to join this group. New Zealand, India, and in my grab bag of stuff I never throw away, I got the original copies of the magazine and the meeting that I was invited to. New Zealand, India, and a rather loosely organized group in the United States, including Walter Lippmann, the Dean of American Journalists, almost worshipped by the news media who want to be like him, Irwin D. Cannon of the Christian Science Monitor, and others. The attitudes of the various groups were coordinated by frequent visits and discussions, and by a well-informed and totally anonymous, they're not looking for credit until Quigley decided to get it, totally anonymous quarterly magazine, The Round Table, whose first issue, written largely by Philip Kerr, appeared in November 1910. The leaders of this group were Milner until his death, followed by Curtis, the Sermon on the Mount man, Robert Brand, brother-in-law of Lady Astor, who owned the Times, until his death in 63. And now Adam D. Maris, son of Sir William and Brand's successor, as managing director of Lazard Brothers Bank. To you that know finance, you know where we're going. I mean, you're going to find the Rothschilds, J.P. Morgan's group, and the successors, the Rockefellers. The original intention had been to have a collegial leadership. That's a fancy word for democratic. But Milner was too secretive and headstrong to share the role. You mean preachers are not the only ones that just say, I'm the boss? He did so in the period 1913 to 19. That's the only time that he had regular meetings with some of his closest friends to coordinate their activities as a pressure group in the struggle with Germany in those days. This they called their ginger group. After Milner's death, I mean, for a short time he did some committee meeting, but then he just ran it himself. After Milner's death, the leadership was largely shared with the survivors of Milner's kindergarten. That is, the group of young Oxford men. He used his civil servants in his reconstruction of South Africa in 1901 to 1910. Brand was the last survivor of the kindergarten. Since his death, the greatly reduced activities of the organization have been exercised largely through the editorial committee of the Round Table magazine under Adam Maris. Money came originally from the associates and followers of Cecil Rhodes, chiefly from the Rhodes Trust itself, and from wealthy associates, and from the Astor family. Since 1925, there have been substantial contributions from wealthy individuals and from foundations and firms associated with the International Banking Fraternity. Now, that's the difference between Bank of America and Glendale Saving that loans to people. The International Banking Fraternity loans to governments. And giant corporations that are also international, from primarily governments. Since 1925, from wealthy individuals and from foundations and firms associated with the international banking fraternity, especially the Carnegie United Kingdom Trust and other organizations associated with J.P. Morgan, the Rockefeller and Whitney families, and the associates of Lazard Brothers and of Morgan, Grenfell and Company. The chief backbone of this organization grew up along the already existing financial cooperation running from the Morgan Bank in New York to a group of international financiers in London led by Lazard Brothers. Milner himself, in 1901, had refused a fabulous offer worth up to $100,000 a year. Now, any associate of mine would have taken $100,000 a year and badmouthed me to death. But they got the money that even $100,000 a year can't attract them. $100,000 to be... He refused that to become one of the three partners of the Morgan Bank in London. Who in the world wants $100,000 a year when you can be that? In succession to the younger J.P. Morgan, who moved from London to join his father in New York. Instead, Milner became director of a number of public banks, chiefly the London Stock Bank, corporate precursor of the Midland Bank. It became one of the greatest political and financial powers in England, with his disciples strategically placed throughout England in significant places, such as the editorship of the Times, the editorship of the Observer, the managing directorship of Lazard Brothers. He had them all brainwashed. They were his little lackeys. Even cabinet positions. Ramifications were established in politics, high finance, Oxford and London universities, periodicals, the civil service, and tax-exempt foundations. Boy, if a preacher would do that, they'd put him in jail for brainwashing. This is a member, mind you, of this establishment. Now he starts attacking on 949 what he calls the radical right and their version of what has been going on in America, and he's going to give the true version now. He says the radical right version of these events, as written up by John T. Flynn, Frieda Utley, and others, he calls their version remote from the truth. He says this is a radical right fairy tale, that it's some kind of conspiracy worldwide seeking to bring about a communist plot. But then he goes on to say, this myth, like all fables, does in fact have a modicum of truth. Now, he's right. This is where I depart from some of the radical rights. They're not communists. They consider themselves above communists. The communists are pawns on their chessboard just like everybody else is. Now, those like Joseph McCarthy and others that saw them using, because they're worldwide in their influence, the dollar is their real god, but they have brainwashed themselves into thinking they're bettering mankind. Now again, social philosophy is higher than a particular implementation of it. Fascism is a social philosophy. Nazism was one kind of execution of it. Fascism simply says there is some elite that knows what's best for everybody, and democracy is that which is the greatest good for the greatest number. And it deifies the majority as the norm, puts everybody in it except the elite group that claims to have the inside knowledge, and they manage the world. Now, Hitler Germany was a derivation of that, and instead of deifying the elite group, they deified the state. So they were a precursor of Antichrist in form of government. They deified the state. And as Reinhold Niebuhr has said, once they committed that rebellion sin, which is not to be satisfied with sin, but when the conscience bothers you in your shortcomingness, you get a rationale that is moral to cover up your sins, and you brainwash yourself into thinking that your sin is really not sin after all. And as he rightly points out, the Nazis seared their conscience by their Aryan myth and their deification of the state to where they felt that everything they did, such as the annihilation of the Jews, had the higher purpose for the good of all mankind, and in that step, they made the second sin easier to commit because they'd already brainwashed themselves into thinking their first sin was not sin after all when they set the state up in place of God. These people are an elite of privilege. The primary cause of privilege, money and brains. And they can only live with themselves by their Sermon on the Mount moral theory, by the way they use their power to better mankind. They are internationalists. They're not communists. They're internationalists, seeking to manage everything, including communism. And Quigley, the insider's right. He says, this myth that it's a communist conspiracy, like all fables, does in fact have a modicum of truth. And we're getting down to the self-confession now. There does exist, and has existed for a generation, listen close, an international Anglophile network which operates to some extent in the way the radical right believes the communists act. In fact, this network, which we may identify, and you are going to say to me, are you trying to tell me that every member of CFR and the various members of the press and the banking institution and all of those people are knowing members of this network syndrome? Absolutely not. They're the drones. They're the brainwashed ones by the secret society who don't come out and say, keep us rich by keeping us in our place and carrying forth this program that feeds the banks but keeping governments in debts and does the moral work of social welfare. They preach a gospel of do-goodism. Half the people that are in the organizations they train, such as CFR, are not philosophers. I went through higher education, through the master's degree, to a general secondary credential on the teaching of social sciences without ever having a course in philosophy of education. I had to be in the doctoral program at Stanford before I found out what philosophy I had been forced to adopt as my teaching method in order to get a credential. They have brainwashed the world from a secret frame of reference. This network does, in fact, exist. In fact, this network, which we may identify as, listen close, the Round Table Groups, has no aversion to cooperating with the communists or any other groups, and frequently does. Why? Well, listen to dear old Brother Curtis. If political power is granted to groups before they're fit, they'll tend to rise to the need. Fanatical conviction that with the proper spirit and proper organization, the kingdom of God could be established on earth. They're basically good. They have a different political philosophy, but they're basically good. The North Vietnamese are out for the good, and here comes some Hollywood starlet over there. She probably knows about as much philosophy as William Friedman. They sell the humanitarian gabarge. You wonder where that word's found? You got to get my dictionary. This network, which we may identify as the Roundtable Groups, has no aversion to cooperating with the communists or any other groups, and frequently does. I know of the operations of this network because I have studied it for 20 years. And was permitted for 2 years in the early 1960s to examine its papers and secret records. He was one of their inner circle, that's why. I have no aversion to it or to most of its aims, and have for much of my life been close to it and to many of its instruments. I have objected, both in the past and recently, to a few of its policies, notably to its belief that England was an Atlantic rather than a European power and must be allied or even federated with the United States and must remain isolated from Europe. But in general, my chief difference of opinion is that it wishes to remain unknown. And I believe its role in history is significant enough to be known. So I'm going to tell it. Well, golly and begorry. Now, at the end of the war in 1914, it became clear that the organization of this system had to be greatly extended. Once again, the task was entrusted to Lionel Curtis, Sermon on the Mount brother, who established in England and each dominion a front organization, because the secret society's got to stay back there, a front organization to the existing local roundtable group. Now, you know what I've been criticized for? More than anything else, I've been criticized for this. Being smart enough to organize this church in a way that the C student bureaucrats couldn't figure out what we were doing. Because that elite that controls them and that bunch of dummies that feed off of them get scared spitless that God could have a man anywhere even half as smart as them that could use for God's glory and purposes some of their techniques to defeat them. I'm going to get them. Instead of being criticized for the way I've organized, well, a couple of my ex-associates are on record saying, the dirty crook, he even said when he came here he was going to so complicate things it'd take the government 5 years to figure out what was here if they got in. That's supposed to be a secret revelation. Haven't I said that over and over again? Told the board that when it came here. Not only that, it'll take them 15 years now. In fact, you want to know the truth? They wouldn't get it figured out till Jesus comes. A front organization to the existing local roundtable group. This front organization called the Royal... See, all my brethren over there have been brainwashed with Lionel Curtis' sweet talk. Oh, God ordained these blessed badge-toting bureaucratic sons of Beelzebub. That's my view of them. Got to be nice and bow down to them. They're in sin, but if you give them a little trust, they'll rise to the opportunity. Brother Lionel Curtis told him that years ago. Now, if you just be sweet, Scott, they wouldn't give you any problem. You're your own worst problem. You create conflict. So, my sweet evangelical brethren, give these people no trouble at all. They even preach a social gospel. And if you want the news to approve you, quit preaching sin and salvation, hell and heaven, and start preaching a social gospel. Then you prove your right to exist. And they try to slip past the Waltz case at the Supreme Court and make a church. And I got dumb pastors willing to bow down to this. Prove our right to have tax exemption by the social welfare that we do. Check your records, folks. Smiley Smiley, Melodyland, has a welfare exemption. They don't have a church exemption. Tomorrow, our church is going to be sold to the state for taxes, and all hell's going to break loose. And if some of you listening of the old guard just about had a heart attack, that ought to tell you, you ain't going to make it with Scott, so just go find one of those rocking chair churches. Let's go back to Quigley. A front organization. They also, they never have anybody deflect. They don't have ex-associates badmouthing them because they can pay them. But the managed mind of the press would have you believe, a la Sermon on the Mount, a la Charles Sheldon in his steps, a la Jesus, poor? Sure he was. But he knew just exactly which fish to tell Peter to put his finger in his mouth and take a gold coin out of. Who needs a bank account if you can do that? I mean, that gets it when you want it, and they don't get any taxes on it either. Until you're ready to pay it. Carry it around, mouth that dumb fish. Fish serving God. Jesus lived the Sermon on the Mount. And thanks be to God, because I couldn't if I tried. He removed the necessity of me doing it. I'm saying to all my evangelical brethren tonight what Paul said to the Galatian church. Who hath bewitched you? The press would have you believe that the only man fit to be a minister is one who barely keeps his head above water on the lower 10% of income in this land. And they would have me pay associates such small salaries that the devil can get them every time they start to backslide. If I could give them $250,000 a year and $500,000 a year and $1 million a year like the big foundations can give fellow travelers with communists, I wouldn't have any traitors. The church is losing by default, because the world's view of it is anybody that believes what evangelical Christianity believes about eternity and the resurrection of Jesus Christ and the power of God's Spirit to change lives and the real New Testament frame of reference is so dumb they couldn't make it doing anything else but practicing witchery, and they don't deserve more than $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 a year. And in order to win the brethren and shun the very appearance of evil, we'll drive a Ford. We live in a three-bedroom tract. And we'll tell the world how poor we are. Hooray! I thank God I got a congregation pays me more than any preacher in the world, makes me rich every day so I can be poor for Jesus' sake. And the next guy that tells you, your pastor drives a limousine? No, it doesn't. He has a driver, by the way. He gets criticized for that, too, but there are two of them now. Limousines, that is. There's seriousness in what I'm doing. I've proven for 2 years I don't need any more than I had. But it's about time the world out there understand that God ought to have the best, and the only brains in the world don't belong to this crowd. A front organization called the Royal Institute of International Affairs had as its nucleus in each area the existing submerged round table group. Submerged. In New York, it was known as the front organization. In New York, it was known as the Council on Foreign Relations. And was a front for J.P. Morgan and Company in association with the very small American Roundtable Group. The American organizers were dominated by the large number of Morgan experts who had gone to the Paris Peace Conference and there became close friends with a similar group of English experts, which had been recruited by the Milner Group. In fact, the original plans for the Royal Institute of International Affairs and the Council on Foreign Relations were drawn up at Paris. The Council of the RIIA, which by Curtis Energy came to be housed, Curtis, Sermon on the Mount, came to be housed in Chatham House across St. James Square from the Astors, who owned the Times, and was soon known by the name of this headquarters, and the board of the Council on Foreign Relations have carried ever since the marks of their origin. Until 1960, the Council at Chatham House was dominated by Milner Associates. while the paid staff members were largely the agents of Lionel Curtis. Poor people. You know, they couldn't make any decisions for themselves. They were brainwashed by Lionel Curtis. Poor people. I mean, if they hadn't been paid so well, they'd have defected. The Round Table for years was edited from the back door of the Chatham House grounds in Ormond Yard, and his telephone came through the Chatham House. The New York branch was dominated by the associates of the Morgan Bank. For example, in 1928, the Council on Foreign Relations had John Davis as president, Paul Cravath as vice president, and on through big names in America. I'm going to read on fast. I got Walter Lippmann in the list. That one you'll get. The academic figures have been linked to Morgan, and they're all named. The Wall Street contacts with these were created originally from Morgan's influence in handling large academic endowments. In the case of the largest of these endowments, that at Harvard, the influence was usually exercised indirectly through State Street in Boston, which for much of the 20th century came through the Boston banker Nelson, Thomas Nelson Perkins. Closely allied with this Morgan influence were a small group of Wall Street law firms and the long list of their names. On this basis, which was originally financial, I told you when it started tonight, and goes back to George Peabody, there grew up in the 20th century a power structure between London and New York which penetrated deeply into university life, the press, and the practice of foreign policy. University life, the press, and the practice of foreign policy. In England, the center was the Round Table Group, while in the United States, it was J.P. Morgan and Company, or its local branches in Boston, Philadelphia, and Cleveland. Some rather incidental examples of the operations of this structure are very revealing, just because they are incidental. For example, it's set up in Princeton. A reasonable copy of the Round Table Group's chief Oxford headquarters, All Souls College. This copy, called the Institute for Advanced Study, and best known perhaps as the refuge of Einstein, Oppenheimer, John von Neumann, and George F. Kennan, was organized by Abraham Flexner of the Carnegie Foundation and Rockefeller's General Education Board after he, Rockefeller, had experienced the delights of All Souls while serving as Rhodes Memorial Lecturer at Oxford. The plans were largely drawn by Tom Jones, one of the Round Table's most active intriguers and foundation administrators. Listen, the American branch of this English establishment exerted much of its influence through five American newspapers. This is an insider talking. The New York Times, New York Herald Tribune, Christian Science Monitor, The Washington Post, and the lamented Boston Evening Transcript. In fact, the editor of the Christian Science Monitor was the chief American correspondent, anonymously. Very few people know this. I'll read it again. In fact, the editor of the Christian Science Monitor was the chief American correspondent, anonymously, of the Round Table. Their secret society paper. And Lord Lothian, the original editor of the Round Table and later secretary of the Rhodes Trust, 25 to 1939, and ambassador to Washington, was a frequent writer in the Monitor. It might be mentioned that the existence of this Wall Street Anglo-American axis is quite obvious once it is pointed out. It is reflected in the fact that such Wall Street luminaries as John W. Davis, Lewis Douglas, Jock Whitney, and Douglas Dillon were appointed to be American ambassadors in London, if you don't think behind-the-scenes people determine what goes on. This double international network, in which the Round Table groups formed the semi-secret or secret nuclei of the Institutes of International Affairs, was extended into a third network in 1925, organized by the same people for the same motives. Once again, the mastermind was Lionel Curtis, Sermon on the Mount. And the earlier roundtable groups and institutes of international affairs were used as nuclei for the new network. However, this new organization for Pacific affairs was extended to 10 countries, while the roundtable groups existed only in 7. Now I can see people with the 10 toes of the Roman, of the image of Nebuchadnezzar, suddenly finding a new political, prophetical theory. Don't do it. In Canada, new additions, ultimately, China, Japan, France, the Netherlands, Soviet Russia, and Pacific, had Pacific councils set up from scratch. Now, do you understand why Taiwan was sold out and China sold in? In England, Chatham House served as the English center for both networks. While in the United States, the two were parallel creations of the Wall Street allies of the Morgan Bank. The financing came from the same international banking groups and their subsidiary commercial and industrial firms. Oh, I can go on and on and on. One of the most interesting members of the Anglo-American power structure was Jerome Green, 1874 to 59, born in Japan of missionary parents, Sermon on the Mount do-gooder. Green graduated from Harvard's College and Law School by 1899 and became secretary to Harvard's president and corporation in 1901 to 1910. This gave him contacts with Wall Street, which made him general manager of the Rockefeller Institute. Assistant to John D. Rockefeller in philanthropic work for 2 years. Then trustee to the Rockefeller Institute, to the Rockefeller Foundation, to the Rockefeller General Education Board. Well, interlocking directorates. I mean, you know, when a preacher does it in a church, it's criminal. For 15 years, he was with the Boston investment banking firm of Lee Higginson and Company. As executive secretary of the American section of the Allied Maritime Transport Council stationed in London, he lived in Toynbee Hall, the world's first settlement house. As an investment banker, Green is chiefly remembered for his sales of millions of dollars of the fraudulent securities of the Swedish match king, Ivar Kruger. Green offered these to the American investing public in good faith is evident from the fact that he put a substantial part of his own fortune in the same investments. Well, he ends up still a hero, just like we have fellow travelers with the communists pointed to the World Bank. Now, I can go on and on and on. What am I saying? There is a world network controlled by dollars, justifying what they do, with the message of humanitarianism surrounded by front organizations of drones that they give research grants to. They endow lectureships and professorships at universities. They now hold the key posts and editorial positions, those trained in their foundation and university and specialty study areas. They have moved from newspapers to the control of NBC, ABC, and CBS. They are a people who cater to the mob out there and their tastes, give them security through welfare programs against government debt that borrows from their banks that fund their secret organizations, and they're an international network who believe themselves the right people to rule the world, who knows what's best for the most, and it doesn't matter, as Rothschild said, who's in government if I control the money? Now, a voice like mine is a threat to them. A voice like mine doesn't sing the party line. A voice like mine hasn't been brainwashed that the good of all mankind is social welfare down here. Better die like Paul in prison, go to heaven. It's been long and heavy. But whether you remember the details or not, there's not an intelligent person listening to me that didn't get the insight that behind the scenes there is a network of self-appointed brain trusters controlling the major money of this world that really run the affairs. And the Trilateral Commission seeks to remove the United States from chief among powers to peer among equals, and seeks to set up a trilateral axis in the Pacific and the United States and Europe. And they are one-worlders who dominated the League of Nations, who dominated the United Nations, who have put in the chief posts of the bureaucracy of international affairs in the United States over the last three decades the leading voices who control banking and are the bureaucracy on which the government sits, who finally thought they had what was necessary in the born-again craze of the world. They had their little Peter Sellers being their president. To you that have seen that movie, they'd get a peanut farmer that had suddenly been given the wondrous, high, ethereal air of being a member of the CFR. And as a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, they could get themselves a little dodo out there that they could run the world with. But he was so dodoed that they lost that round and they retreated underground again. But Reagan better watch out, because they're going to get him too. And the more he travels in the moneyed crowds, the more he climbs on that white horse they're riding. And this world better pray that the Gene Scott stay alive. And some of you weak-kneed Christians out there need to understand, I don't ask you to fight this battle. I'm fighting it, and I'm taking the lumps. You could support it. Now, me and Ken are going to talk. I'll bet you didn't know, Ken, that that country that you came from spawned so much dastardly Antichrist embryonic expressions.
I'm scared to death now. I'm going to be attacked from both sides. The people that don't know well enough are going to attack me for being British and being a part of that beginning. And those who do are going to attack me because I'm associated with you fighting the big boys. It's frightening.
Yes, it is.
It's frightening.
Convincing?
Very convincing.
Only an insider could tell the story that way.
Yes.
And yet, let me ask you, because you'll get around to asking me before we're finished. How right am I, Ken, in asking modern evangelical Christianity, who hath bewitched you?
How right? Right on. I'm just expressing my opinion about it, but your evaluation of that whole Sermon on the Mount thesis was beautifully done. I wonder if people really understand what they were listening to tonight, because they would never hear anything like that on any other network, on any other station. Like you said, you challenge CBS, NBC, ABC. Would they ever speak about these things? And would a president survive if he ever did speak about things like this? The answer is rhetorical, because of course they wouldn't. But I wonder if people realize, if they appreciate the fact that here is a voice that is willing and capable. There's a lot of us that are willing to do it, but incapable of being able to express it and evaluate or understand what we are reading. But to have a voice that's both capable and courageous enough to be able to bring this out into the open, I wonder if people really appreciate it. Your question about evangelicals, I don't think you could be more correct there, Gene. That's right on. They have...
They start their walk with an evangelical definition of salvation, and they continue their walk with a liberal standard of behavior.
I agree.
They start out recognizing the alienation from the world, the repentance the other world in need of redemption, the other world in need of regeneration and born-againness. And then they turn around and try to win the world with their behavior. Instead of recognizing, I know, Ken, because there were years that I simply felt it was good character for me not to preach anything that I didn't live. I wrote an article years ago on what it really means to be like Christ. And the starting point was, he did what he talked about better than he talked about it. He told everybody to bear a cross, and he bore a heavier one. He told people to deny themselves for the will of the Father, and he emptied himself of more than anybody could ever give up. Mm-hmm. Heaven's glory. Mm-hmm. He taught humility. He stepped the lowest. He taught obedience. He was obedient unto death. So with heroic, good intentions, I felt that it was simply morally wrong for me to preach something I didn't live. Now, there are thousands of people I say, I'm not going to be a Christian until I live it. Now, the shallow thinker immediately says, aha, he's going to preach license now. No, I'm not. I'm avoiding the sin that the neo-Orthodox people rightly defined. The sin of all sins that finds an ideal a little above myself but below God and pulls God down to it and me up to it. And then God is prostituted lower than he is, and we're elevated in spiritual pride to an accomplishment that we think will suffice when it won't. And it removes the tension of evangelical Christianity, the warfare of Galatians 5 between the flesh and the spirit. There are those that say that Scott doesn't come down hard enough on sin, and he's opening the door to license. No, I'm not. I recognize the constant tension of warfare, and only a dumb idiot that thinks he's arrived fails to recognize he's been bewitched into a side road where there's no longer any warfare, because he doesn't even know the war is going on. He thinks he's already won it. Mm-hmm. Now, the issue of evangelical Christianity is that they introduce the crisis change and the evangelical confrontation with God as a person. Then once that salvation experience begins, they, like the Galatians, slip back into a liberal carry-on, to where the average sermon every Sunday morning is on how you ought to live. It is liberal preaching, because liberal preaching dominates without them knowing it. The seminaries, they would rise up and come at me, because they're biblicists. And I say, no, you're not. You are putting biblical texts on liberal theories. Mm-hmm. And the liberalists don't need the text to preach it. They just preach it as do-goodism. So they'll take a sermon off of an Anglican pulpit of the commentaries from Matthew Henry through all of them, whether it's Anglican in origin or subsequent researcher out of the Anglican theories. They're still going to go a long ways to beat the scholarship, the pulpit commentary. But if you don't have your philosophy right, you will be warped by it. So they pull the concept out of the sermon, put biblical texts on them, but they are not preaching evangelical Christianity. They are immediately pounding the saints into an effort of performance, and it ultimately boils down into sweetness, love, and do-goodism. And it lacks the cutting edge of New Testament Christianity, which is salty, which brings a sword, which divides as well as brings together, which introduces warfare and demands struggle and labor and faith to enter into the rest which is God. And I sound like I am strange, because they have so grafted onto the brainwashed constituency of Christianity the imitation of Christ as what Christianity is. And that is not what Christianity is. As Tozier said, it's the reproduction of Christ in the warfare with the flesh, not the imitation of Christ and the disappearance of the flesh.
Yes.
And they have lost the battle, because that's what Antichrist will club them with. He will come on the scene and make them prove their Christianity by becoming passive and sweet and being no troublemaker. And he'll set up his kingdom.
Yes.
See, if you'd have said I was wrong, we'd have had a fight.
No, I can't. No.
Because there's some things I know I'm right on. But I knew what you're going to say. Because we've talked before.
Yes.
On planes.
It's beautiful. Who is it? Griffith Thomas, that says that Christianity is Christ. And that's a beautiful presentation of the truth of it. That I couldn't live up to the Sermon on the Mount, no matter how committed or dedicated I could be to God. It is impossible for me to do it. But he did. He is the only one that did. And in the beautiful program of redemption, he offered to me, graciously, that I could put all of the weight of my guilt and my shame upon him. And he would correspondingly transfer to me all the effectiveness of his performance of that Sermon on the Mount, so that I can stand in the presence of God because I'm in him and I am complete in him.
Yeah, but what you got is his performance, not yours.
Not mine. And that, if I understand what you're saying.
Absolutely.
That's where you are.
And what the Hebrews letter says, it says, whose house ye are, speaking of us being the habitation of God, if you continue steadfast. And the Greek has it, if the same way you started is the way you keep going. Now, how do you start? A sinner who accepts God's grace in the confession of faith, and you become what you are not, and what he is moves into a house undeserving of his presence, and the warfare starts. But you will remain his house. Second year, third year, fourth year, fifth year Christian, if your relationship is maintained the same way it got started, which by absolute logical deduction says it still is going to be a faulty house with warfare going on, whether or not Gene Scott will yield to the new life that's moved into the unworthy house or go back as the dog to his vomit or the pig to his wallow. But it's a choice of life energy. And the moment that evangelical Christianity moves into that bewitched position, that I can come in by grace and faith, but I'm maintained by, they won't say it, but they preach it.
Yes.
Works.
Absolutely.
What's the condemnation that the church world lays on me? I don't look and act and perform like the proper cleric. I'm not seeking defense tonight because they're wrong. Anybody needs defense tonight, they do.
Yes.
Not me.
Yes.
They're wrong. But I wanted to lay it in history tonight from the 6th chapter of Revelations that it is the evangelical church playing into the hands of Antichrist. He wants nothing more than this lay down and die sweet talk. God doesn't want honey in the meat offering. And the meat offering is the symbol of dedicated Christian service. And honey turns sweet under pressure. And God doesn't want honey in the meat offering. Now that ought to tell us enough. Now why people won't support this ministry more than they do, I don't know.
No.
But I'm glad that some people who do support it more than human reason could believe found out a little more tonight why they do.
I would like to say to you what a tremendous blessing you are to me personally when I hear you ministering the Word of God, like a, you know, interwoven into all that you were saying tonight. You were an old fundamental Bible thumping preacher. I mean, right on, hitting it where it has to be hit. And I know that everybody heard what I listened to. But I don't know if there was another person listening that ever got the thrill of the soul that I received in hearing you say it. And you do it so many times for me. And if I have sown unto you spiritual things, is it a great thing if I reap your carnal things? There isn't enough gold in the world to be able to compensate you for the ministry that you've given to me. And just like what you were doing tonight. I've listened to you, Gene, on Sunday nights when you're on that book of Romans. And I, you see, I'm not Pentecostal. If I were, I'd be crawling the ceiling upside down, you know. I'd be bouncing on the floor and flying through the window, and I have to stay with my
Baptist. I'd say sit down. But go ahead.
Oh, you just don't know what you do to my soul when I hear you minister the word like you do. And I would lay you as a preacher of God's grace beside any contemporary that lives in this world, and brethren that are listening to me know well of what I'm speaking. They just haven't listened to you if they haven't received the same thrill that I've received. And it's worth anything that they can give. And I don't know if you're asking a question about participation, no, but I thought it's
I'm
worth
getting embarrassed.
Saying. Pardon me?
I'm getting embarrassed.
No, I don't want to embarrass you. I never want to cause you in any way to change anything that you are. You are God's man. And God has given you an insight and a gift and the courage to stand and say, because I know, we all know, that you can't stand in your pulpit and preach the way that you preach with the background that you have and the people to whom you minister without having courage to say that truth eventually will produce the product that God by grace wants me to be a channel to produce. And brother, I love you for doing it. I praise the Lord for you. It's great.
Well, I got some ex-associates that don't feel that way.
I wish we were.
You got any, more you got any comment on that?
On the ex-associate?
Yeah.
They're not worth talking about, those reprobates.
I'm going to go home on that.